We're not in Ecclesiastes today. We're in a psalm written by Solomon, the same guy that wrote Ecclesiastes. And the psalm, its underlying foundational theme is investing in people rather than projects. And I've called this message building a house or a home. Have you ever thought of your dream home? Maybe you've not articulated it, but have you thought, if I could be anywhere, have any kind of a home, what would it be like? What view would you have? How many bedrooms would it have, etc.? A publication known as The Professional Builder said the average American thinks the ideal home is a one-story, single-family, ranch-style house on at least a half an acre with three bedrooms, two baths, a full basement, and at least a two-car garage. Now, where I was this last week, as I was snorkeling and jet skiing, suffering for the Lord, I saw some very fabulous homes in some of the populated islands. One that had four stories that just sort of terraced the hillside with its private pool and walkway and its own private dock with its yacht and laden with palm trees. It was paradise. We would call that paradise. But it takes more than that. That's a house. It was a very wonderful house, an enviable house perhaps, but there's a difference between having a house, a structure, and a home. And many people who spend all of their time building up the house have a home life that's in shambles. I heard about a guy that went to the Super Bowl game this last week, and he was there. He was given tickets from his company. He got free tickets, so he went in, but his seat was the last row, way up in the corner. He was closer to the Goodyear blimp than he was the field. During the first quarter, he saw that there was a seat about 10 rows back on the 50-yard line vacant. So he just kept looking at that seat, and nobody filled it. So eventually, after the first quarter, he walks down, moseys his way through the crowd, presses his way through the security, and there's that empty seat. And he says to the guy sitting next to it, he says, "Excuse me, is this seat vacant? Can I take it? Can I sit here?" The guy said, "Take it. It's yours." So the man, big smile on his face, sits down. And says, "You know, this is incredible. I mean, who in their right mind would have this good of a seat at the Super Bowl and not use it?" And the man sitting next to him said, "Well, actually, it's my seat. And normally, I bring my wife every year to the Super Bowl game, but she passed away." He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I didn't know. That's sad." He said, "Still, surely you could get somebody who would want to take that seat, a relative, a close friend." The guy said, "No, they're all at the funeral." You know, that guy had a bad home life. What's really sad is right now some of you guys give me this look like, "So?" That's what I'm worried about. As you read this psalm, it presents two different contrasting paths, you might say. One that's filled with frustration, anxiety, lack of fulfillment, because the emphasis is on the project, the house. The other, the last part of it, is a painting, a picture, a portrait of fulfillment, satisfaction, because the emphasis isn't on a project, but people. It's on building a home. Let's read through the psalm, and we'll see that twofold division. "Unless the Lord builds the house," says Solomon, "they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with their enemies in the gate." This is a psalm, a poem, a Hebrew poem, written in Hebrew parallelism. It's divided into two strophes, two divisions of poetic language. The first one is verses 1 and 2. The second strophe, really the second thought, is verses 3 through 5. Two ways to live: house, home, projects, people. Somebody once said, home is where life makes up its mind. It's a good way to think of a home. Where we start from is the template that molds our convictions, our attitudes, our belief system. It makes an imprint on us. And home life, contrary to what many people believe, has a greater influence on a child than school, friends, church, and media. If you think of the emotional leverage just because of the time spent at home, the average child may spend, if his parents bring that child to church, 52 hours a year at church. Going to school, they'll spend maybe 40 hours a week for 9 months of the year at school. But that child will spend more than 60 hours a week at home. It is written by Solomon. It says, a song of ascents of Solomon. That's what makes it a unique psalm, and that's why I've inserted it sort of right in the middle of our study on Ecclesiastes. Because Solomon has covered so much territory in searching for meaning, trying to build up his life through experiences, then there's a change in the book, and perhaps, just maybe, this psalm fits there in terms of chronology of Solomon's life. By the way, Solomon would be uniquely qualified to speak about both of these issues: building a house, building a home, projects, people. He was a great builder of houses, of temples, of structures. He also had a big family, 700 wives, 300 concubines. This guy can write about both of these paths. So we want to look at a twofold division this morning: a house built on vanity, a home built on values. Let's look more carefully at verses 1 and 2. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Notice the repetition of a word three times in two verses. It's a word that, if you've followed carefully in the book of Ecclesiastes, raises a flag. It's the word what? Vain. That's a Solomon word, man. That's a catchphrase he used a lot. Vain to build, vain to guard, vain to get up early, stay up late and worry about life. In fact, for the record, once again, in the book of Ecclesiastes, he uses the word 33 times. Here he uses it three times in this one psalm. There's another phrase that Solomon used, sort of combining the thought of vanity and emptiness. He says, vanity of vanities. That's the superlative of being like the most vain. There are empty things in life, but then there's vanity of vanities. That's the most empty, useless thing there is. And he applies that to building and to watching, or to guarding and to worrying. A couple of things that promote a house built on vanity. Number one, unblessed labor. He mentions the building of a house, the guarding of a city, without God. I'd like to read that verse to you in a version some of you have heard of. Many of you maybe have never heard of the version called The Message, written by Eugene Peterson, a very fresh rendition of the Scriptures. Peterson translates that verse this way: if God doesn't build the house, the builders only build shacks. If God doesn't guard the city, the night watchman might as well nap. In other words, this is unblessed labor. It's frustrating and arrogant to try to build or preserve anything in life apart from God. He calls it vain. He says to the outlook that says, it's up to you, man. You build your life. You protect your assets. You, your prowess. Solomon would say, vain, vain, vain. And he would know. After all, just remember what Solomon did as soon as he came upon the throne in Israel. He wrote a letter to the king up north called Hiram, who lived up in Lebanon, Tyre of Lebanon. Wrote him a letter, something like this: "Dear Hiram, how's it going? I'd like you to cut down some of those big trees you have growing up there, those cedars of Lebanon and cypress trees, and ship them on a raft and bring them down to Joppa. In exchange, I'll give you oil and wine and wheat. We'll trade commodities." And he took that lumber and he took the local stone in Jerusalem, and this guy went building on a building spree. The best craftsmen, the best materials, the best stuff. First of all, he built the house. That's what they call it. The temple in Jerusalem, the house of the Lord. It took him 7.5 years just to build God's temple. Then just down the street, almost like next door neighbors, on a little section of Jerusalem called Ophel, he built his own private residence, the palace for the king. But get this, he spent 7.5 years building God's house. He took 13 years building his own pad. Then he built waterworks, and he built gardens, and he built chalets up in Lebanon. He went to town. Not only was he a builder of houses, of structures, but he was a guardian, somebody who watched and kept the defense of Israel at an all-time high. He built defense cities at strategic points throughout Israel. And if you ever make it to Israel with us, hope you come this year, but if you ever come, we'll take you to a place called Megiddo, where the Valley of Armageddon is, and we'll show you what archaeologists have uncovered called the Solomonic Gate, or the Gates of Solomon. It was a structure that had 4 interlocking gates. Get this, if an invader or a group came in and could penetrate the first gate, they would then be in a room, a hallway, facing a second gate. And on top of the walls, it was an open structure, there would be poised people with bows, arrows, rocks, hot boiling oil. It was the welcoming committee for the town, for the invaders. And then you'd have to make it through the second gate, another structure, third gate, another structure, fourth gate, you'd be inside the city. That was the Gate of Solomon. He guarded the cities after he built the houses. But he says, unless the Lord guards it, man, it's empty, it's vain. And it was. For when he built the house of God, after he dedicated the temple, God spoke to him and said this: "If you or the kings who succeed you ever turn away from following me, this house will become a heap of ruins." And guess what happened? Solomon turned from God. The kings after him did it worse. And eventually God didn't protect the city anymore. And the city went into captivity for 70 years in Babylon. Let's apply that. You could apply this idea to the person who's driven, workaholic perhaps, the high overachiever, who builds the house and neglects the home, who builds the project, forgets the people. It's the business, the corporation, the project, the ministry, whatever, apart from God's fueling. And so while the house looks impressive and built up, the home life, the people are in disrepair. The relationships suffer. The ancient Greeks had an interesting proverb. I've always liked it. The proverb is this: if you always keep the bow bent, eventually it will break. If you always keep the bow bent, tension on the bow, eventually it's going to give way. So it is in life. To the person who lives with, you know, the pedal to the metal, pursuing the project, building up the whatever, apart from God, something is going to break, something will give way, and usually the family does. Most principally, the children suffer. If you've ever flown into Washington, D.C., you may have flown into, there's a couple airports, one airport called Dulles Airport, Dulles Field. Dulles Airport is named after John Foster Dulles, who at one time was the Secretary of State for the United States of America. While he was Secretary of State, Douglas MacArthur II, who was the nephew of the great World War II General Douglas MacArthur, worked in the State Department. And he worked and pursued his projects to the neglect of his family. Well, one night, Dulles called the home of MacArthur. But MacArthur's wife answered, MacArthur wasn't home, not knowing it was John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, the boss. "I'd like to speak to Mr. MacArthur." And she said in a very terse, angry, bitter voice, "MacArthur isn't here." MacArthur is where MacArthur always is, weekdays, weekends, nights, in that office of his. And she hung up. Well, Dulles could cop a clue. He knew this guy needs to be home, so he finally tracked him down and called MacArthur, and he said, "Go home at once, boy. Your home front is crumbling." How's your home front? I'm not asking how the business is going, not asking how successful you are, not asking about the project, the pursuit, the career. How's the home front in your life? Now, you may be married or you may be single, but one day you may have a home front. You may live in a mansion or a shack, a beat-up old apartment. That's irrelevant. All of this applies to all of us. There's an article that I found in Scientific American by Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who looked at trends in American lifestyle that undermine the cohesive nature of families. And in one particular thing that he brought up was called the rat race syndrome. We know what that is. You just push hard. You live intensely. The rat race. This is what he said. "The demands of a job that claim mealtimes, evenings, weekends, as well as days, the trips, the moves necessary to get ahead or simply to hold one's own, the increasing time spent in commuting, entertaining, going out, meeting social and community obligations, all of these produce a situation in which a child often spends more time with a passive babysitter than with a participating parent." Now, I quickly want to balance that out and say to the hardworking man or woman or both, we applaud you for your drive to provide for your family and leave your children a good work ethic. It's admirable. It's admirable. However, just make sure that you're not building, that you're not watching in vain. That the main focus is not the project, but the people. One of the guys that was on the boat out where we were suffering for Christ in the Virgin Islands this week was Don McClure, a guy, a friend of mine who's spoken here before. And Don was talking about his father-in-law, Dr. Phil Anderson. And I remember Phil, Dr. Anderson, as I would call him, from my church days back in Costa Mesa, California. I remember where he'd sit. He was an accomplished physician. And one day, he's in his 90s now, but one day he was putting all of his plaques, his degrees, his awards in his bag to throw out. He was cleaning out the garage. Well, Don saw him throwing out the bag of all of his achievements. He said, "You're not going to throw that out." He goes, "Yeah, I'm going to throw it out. It's done." He said, "Well, you got to be awfully proud of all these accomplishments." He said, "Well, actually, Don, I'm a bit ashamed." And he pulled out one plaque. It was an award for teaching a class at USC Medical Center. It took him 6 months to teach the class. They gave him an award. He said, "You see this plaque? This represents one night a week for 6 months away from my family." Put it back in the bag. He pulled out another plaque. "Here's something from the AMA, American Medical Association. This represents all of the time I could have spent in ministry. And I spent in this." And he provided for his family, and he did a good job. But he regretted the emphasis and the focus of those early years. Look at verse 2. "It is vain," there's his word, "for you to rise up early, to sit up late." Now you might look at that and go, "Yeah, now I'm empowered. The Bible tells me to sleep in and to not work, and I'll just, whatever, Lord." It's not what it's saying. It's finish the context. "To eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep." This is unnecessary anxiety. It's not a person who works hard. Solomon talked about working hard as a virtue. This is the artificial lengthening of days with added anxiety. get up early, stay up late, get the project done and worry about it. You know, you build all day long, you guard all evening long, and then you toss and turn all night long. That's the picture of it. The Living Bible puts it this way: it's senseless for you to work so hard from early morning till late at night, fearing you will starve to death. You know, it's the mindset that says, I can't sleep, man. There's too many problems in the world I haven't solved yet. This is the worry ward. Do you know any people like that? Their life is consumed with this unnecessary anxiety. Now, Solomon says in this short little verse three things about worrying I want you to notice. Number one, worrying is exacting. It takes all of your time. It's exacting. It's vain for you to rise up early and sit up late. All day long, the time will consume away in worry. Second, it's excruciating. Notice the phrase, to eat the bread of what? Sorrows. You know, those driven projects can prey on the mind, can disturb you. You just think it over and over again. It doesn't really lead anywhere. It's just painful, tormenting. 1851 was the year. In 1851, the world wasn't talking about the internet. The world was talking about the greatest invention ever up to that time, steam. That's right, steam. A guy developed this interesting pump to take water out of mines over in England, and out of that developed engines powered by steam. And so in 1851, there was this big convention in Hyde Park in London called the Crystal Palace Exhibition, and all the gadgets powered by steam would be represented, and it was a contest. And so there were steam plows, there were steam looms, there were steam locomotives, steam organs, even a steam cannon. But get this, first place was given to an invention that had 7,000 parts. Turn it on, it was magnificent, made a lot of noise. The pulleys moved, the gears turned, the whistles blew, the bells rang, but it didn't do anything. It was impressive, it was noisy. People turned it on and went, wow, but it didn't do anything. That is worry. You turn it on. What'd you accomplish? Nothing, but that was impressive, wasn't it? Boy, it's easy to confuse activity with accomplishment. Unnecessary anxiety. Third, it's exhausting. That's implied by this phrase, he, that is God, gives his beloved sleep. God wants you to sleep, man, not be a pillow pounder. It's a great gift. You've worked hard all day. Relax. Relax. Enjoy it. Sleep. Worry deprives you of that. It takes away necessary replenishment in the sleep cycle. It can ruin your health. You've heard me before quote to you what Dr. Charles Mayo said about worry. He founded the Mayo Clinic. I guess he would know something about that. He said, in all my years, I've never once met a man who died from overwork. I've met many who have died from worry. He said, worry affects circulation, the glands, respiratory system, everything. Worse than all that, worse than even than bad health, is the important stuff gets left behind. People. People. I read a portion of a biography about George Lucas, the great film producer, multimillionaire guy. Bad family, bad marriage, driven, frustrated, can't seem to quit. He's built a house, an empire, but his home is in shambles. Now let's contrast that with the second portion of this psalm. This is a home built on value. And you notice right off the bat, there's a change. There's no mention about building or guarding or worrying. There's this deeper level. Not a house, but a home. Not making a living, having a life is the idea. And there's a couple things I'd like you to notice in these three verses. Godly relationships, first of all. Look and notice three words in this psalm with me. Notice the word Lord. That title is mentioned three times. It's implied at least twice, maybe even three more times. Lord. It's repeated. The idea of the Lord is repeated. In other words, keep Him at the center focus of your life. Second word I want you to notice is the word in that second set of verses, the word womb, W-O-M-B. That would refer, obviously, to the wife, right? Unless you buy into the Schwarzenegger movie that was put out a few years ago. But this is the wife, the Lord, the womb, the wife. And then children are mentioned twice. Now put those three terms together in your mind. The Lord, the womb, children. Relationships, connections with people, with God at the center, that is a home. That is a home. A home isn't built on vain activities. A home is built on valuable relationships, this way and that way. That's a home. If you were to boil life down to its irreducible minimum, you'd have one thing. Not taxes, not income, not projects, relationships. That's all you got. Take away the veneer, you've got relationships. You have a relationship with God this morning, or not. You have relationships with people that are either good or bad. A few years ago, I wrote a book on relationships. I called it Relationships, the Threads of Life. And the idea of the book, I'll tell you the reason I wrote the book is because I gave a poll to you, to this church. Some of you remember that, many of you don't. But I gave a poll to this church. I asked you to write me questions that you wanted answered from the Bible, and I would do a series based on your questions. What I didn't expect is that the overwhelming amount of questions dealt with relationships. Way overwhelming. Relationships about singleness, dating, marriage, staying married, getting along in marriage, ending a marriage, remarriage. All of this relational quagmire questions. And there was a lot of pain in many of those notes that some of you gave me. And I came to realize that some of the loneliest people I've ever known live in the same zip code, under the same roof, and sleep in the same bed. They're in a house, but they really don't enjoy the home. But godly relationships will turn a house into a home. A professor at the University of Nebraska is named Nick Stinnant. He's a researcher for human development and family. He made an observation of successful families, not families that break up, but what makes a family thrive over time. But get this, he studied families not just in America, but in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, South America. And he noticed this. He said, altogether we studied 3,000 families and collected a lot of information. But when we analyzed it all, we found six main qualities in strong families. Strong families, number one, are committed to the family. It's a priority to them. It's important, the family. Second, and it makes sense, follows, they spend time together. That would prove if you really are interested in the family, if you spend time together. Third, they have good family communication. The channels are open. Times are set aside for that. Number four, they express appreciation to one another. You know, that never gets old. Never gets old. I appreciate you. I love you. Forget the attitude that says, I told her I loved her when I married her. I'm a man of my word. We need lots of affirmation daily. Number five, they have a spiritual commitment. The members of the family are committed spiritually. And number six, they are able to solve problems in a crisis. Stop here for a moment and consider Solomon. Right in the middle of the book where we stop to divert to this psalm, if you look back, you see how he went down the first path, projects, works, buildings, study. And he said, vanity, 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 vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And then this sudden turn in the book where he's been speaking about some spiritual things on the way, but really in the middle of the book, he starts looking upward to God and outward to those in his family who meant the most. Then I want you to notice that last part, the godly heritage part. He says, children are a heritage from the Lord. And I realize some of you maybe have one child, like I have. I wanted a bunch of them, but God gave me one. Some of you don't have any, but you'd like some. And that's painful to even talk about this. But you could broaden this and apply it to other family relationships. But get this, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. A heritage, you get that? God passes them on to you. He didn't pass them off onto you. He passes them on to you. It's a heritage, a gift. Now, I know there's episodes in every child's life where parents wonder about this heritage thing. The teen years can be trying, even the early years of dependence. If you have several children, two or three, at the very demanding age. And as somebody once said, that a baby is a digestive apparatus with noise on one end and no responsibility on the other. But it's not true. Children are people on loan from God. It's a heritage. We have a chance to shape a future, a life. Think of it this way. Our kids are the only earthly possessions we will take with us to heaven. Billy Sunday once said, the tragedy of my life, he was the great evangelist, the beginning part of this century, the tragedy of my life is that although I have led thousands of people to Christ, my own sons are not saved. What an ache that must be. And notice the wording of that, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. What a beautiful picture of the launching of children. We find the target, we aim it, we launch them out in hopes that they'll hit the target that God has for that child. That they'll make a difference, make an impact, make a dent in the kingdom of darkness. What a great thought. I'm launching my child and he's going to do damage to Satan's kingdom. I love that idea. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior. Socrates used to say that he wondered how men could be so meticulous in training their colts, their animals, and so indifferent to the training of their children. Socrates could speak to us today, couldn't he? Now, I know we live in a world that makes us tempted to say, oh, this world is so bad. You don't want to raise children in this world. It's so dark and anti-Christ. All the more reason why we need your children. The world needs the kind of children that only you can produce. Launch them, arrows in the hand of a warrior. That's, by the way, the reason at baby dedications, we not only pray for babies, but parents. Because it's all in vain if we just pray for this child, but the parents aren't committed to that whole concept of blessing the child, training the child, launching the child. Is Christ the center of your home? Is Christ the center of your home? Don't answer that by saying, yeah, I got the plaque that says Christ is the unseen guest at every meal. It's in my dining room. I have a big family Bible. Is Christ the center of your home? The evidence of that is the result in the children. Charles Spurgeon said, before a child reaches 7, teach him all the way to heaven. Now, I do want to say this, because some of your children, you have cried over, you have suffered and sorrowed over. You've led them in the right way. You've launched them out. You've prayed for them and gave them a good example. And yet they're adults now and they're making decisions that are maybe apart from Christ. But you know what? It's not over yet. The seed is still in their hearts. God can still do great things. Don't despair. Let me also say something to lighten this up a little bit. Nobody is a perfect parent. I've never met one. Except for my wife, maybe. She's as near perfect as I've ever found. But I've never met somebody who has it, you know, it's on-the-job training, right? By the time you've got experience, you're unemployed. You're just getting it down and they're gone. I remember as a kid thinking, you know, being a parent, this is like easy. You know, kids do all the work and you give all the orders. Till I became one. I thought, this is hard. But if there's one thing we need to get right, one ministry we need to nail down right, that is it. That is it. I'm devoted to that. I hope you're devoted to that. I hope that rather than building the empire, the house, you're building the home. Relationships become the most important to you. I'll sum it up this way. If you're building your life apart from God, it's vanity. If you add to that worry, it's insanity. But if you build upward toward God and outward toward people with God at the center, there you have a valuable commodity.